The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled The Heritage of Cain.
We must linger on this theme for a little while because it takes a huge bite out of history. It covers more ground than anything else. We've got to know it, and if it was missing, as it is from other religions, we wouldn't have the gospel story. Would be far from complete. Very serious defect. So we were on Moses 5, and the Lord says, "What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother cries to me from the ground." Now you notice the purpose of the earth is what? It's to sustain, support life. That's its purpose. During our test here, during our time on earth, every creature is supposed to have its time as far as that goes, but the purpose of the earth is to sustain and support life. And anything that destroys it is against, prematurely certainly, is against the whole purposes for which it was constructed, and the earth is offended. It negates its whole purpose. So, the voice of thy brother cries from the ground, and cursed is the earth which has opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from it. See, he still has a right to life. He has not yet finished his course, yet the earth has a responsibility, and what Cain has done by murder, you see, is why it's such a terrible crime, to curtail life. And so the earth has opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood. And as a result, the earth is not going to give you anything. You've taken life from it now. It will not return life to you, and the earth will not yield her strength when you till it and so forth. Remember, he was a tiller of the earth. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. So he's going to become a nomad and a wanderer. See, he is not agrarian anymore. He's going to become nomadic, and he does. He goes to the land of the nomads, because he can't farm anymore. And there are such people in the earth, as you know. All decadent civilizations, all civilizations that last are rooted in the soil, as you know, but then, as you read in The Deserted Village, ill fares the land, to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulate and men decay. The deserted village when people leave the land. And this is going to happen, and Cain represents another civilization entirely. You notice he goes off, he founds a city, they go into the metalwork business, he's a wanderer, and he becomes a type. And Cain said unto the Lord, and he explains, now Cain, of course, as you might suppose, he is the one who's been injured, and he's the one who's been hurt in court. He said, Satan tempted me because of my brother's flocks. Of course, the thing to do is not to resist temptation, but to avoid it. That's the best way of dealing. But you notice it was because of the flocks. He was greedy. He coveted his properties. We told before, notice he murdered his brother Abel, it tells us, in the fourth chapter here, for the sake of getting gain. See, in the 50th verse, Cain slew his brother Abel for the sake of getting gain. I couldn't resist, because that's what Satan had promised him, remember? That you can murder and get gain. That's the big theme, that you can convert property, life into property. So he couldn't resist. He knew the tricks. He thought he could get away with it and so forth. And also, I was mad because you favored him. Well, you know why that was. This had all been planned by Satan. I was wroth also, for his offering thou accepted, not mine. And my punishment is greater than I can bear. And the Lord still has compassion. He puts a mark on Cain so that he will be saved. You have driven me out from the face of the Lord. He now becomes an outlaw. And the worst penalty you can possibly have is to be driven from the face of the Lord. You will no longer be facing in that direction. You will no longer have much to look forward to if you're driven from the face of the Lord. And from this day, thy face shall be hid. God will be an alien to him. He has alienated himself. He's cutting himself off. Remember in that verse where he turns on his heel and walks out, Cain was wroth and listened not anymore to the Lord. I'm through, and of course, all right. That's it, the way you want it. And he goes all the way through. He carries it through. And then I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the face of the earth. He's become an outlaw now. See, he's taken life. And he's under no law. He can't claim the law's protection because he not only has broken it, but he has taken it into his own hands and taken life on his own. The Lord says, remember, the Lord is the first rule he gives, as it says in the book of Ether. that Lord will not, God will not, that man should shed blood, but has in all things forbidden it since the beginning of man. That's a general order that applies at all times. He's in all time, all things forbidden it since the beginning of man. Cain has broken the rule now, and so he'll be a fugitive and a vagabond. It shall come to pass that he that findeth me will slay thee. And that's the status of the outlaw. See, in ancient societies and in medieval, a person who was outlawed, he had no law to protect him. So anyone who found it was perfectly free to kill him. As far as that goes, he had no protection. To whom could he flee? Who was his protector? See, he had no lord to champion him. He couldn't go to the courts because he was an outlaw. He couldn't go to the king. He had not the protection of the king's highway. He had not the 3 days' protection. He had nothing. So he says, anyone who finds me would be perfectly free to kill me. And because of my iniquities, see, he has a bad reputation, and his name is for evil now, and anywhere he goes, he is going to be at great risk. What can he do? It's a terrible thing. And for these things are not hid from the Lord. But the Lord says to him, the fact that one person kills doesn't justify you in killing him. You do not correct the taking of life by the taking of life. This doesn't give anyone else the right to kill. So it's going to be sevenfold. Anybody who kills Cain will be avenged sevenfold. Because people otherwise will start the rule of vendetta, and that never ends. Then you'll get Northern Ireland, then you'll get the Philippines, where the Moriscos and so forth. Then you'll get the Lebanon and so forth. Because once it's the Arabic rule of the Ghaza, of the raid of the revenge, you get the Jukes and the Kallikaks, the feuding of Kentucky, which only stops, well, of course, the famous border ballads and Percy's relics and so forth, the Douglas and the Percy. They feud for generations and generations, and when does it end? When they're both wiped out. Of course, that's your Book of Mormon theme. It ends the same way with the Jaredites, and it ends the same way with the Nephites, with extermination. This is the old Asiatic theme. It's a very old, very well-established theme. So this will happen, and the Lord says, this is not going to happen. You don't have a right to do that. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. In the Book of Mormon, he says, and it was because the armies of the Nephites went up against the Lamanites that they began to be smitten. Because I had strictly forbidden it, he said, no matter how badly they'd been offended. And so, because once you play that game, there's no end, you see. A murders B, B murders A, well, all right, you murder. As soon as there's a murder committed on both sides, then there's no stopping, because each side said, aha, you did something to us, isn't that terrible? And this goes on forever. So he said, whoever slayeth thee, he is an outlaw, you see, he's a vicious person and all that. Vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And I, the Lord, set a mark upon Cain. We say it's a curse? No, it's so he wouldn't be killed, to mark him. Lest any finding him should kill him, the mark which is on Cain. Now we come to this very interesting thing, and Cain was shut out from the presence of the Lord, and with his wife and many of his brethren, a large troop of migration, they go forth now, and these are the Cainites, and dwelt in the land of Nod. You know what our word Nod is? Nod is the same word in Hebrew. Nod is to move back and forth. And what do you do when you move back and forth? Well, you migrate. You're people that have no settled position. Land of Nod, of course, the migrants and nomads of Central Asia, they tour. They follow the grass with the seasons, but they're always on the march, or with their camels, the Arabs. These nomadic peoples live in the land of Nod, and Nod means migrating, means nomadism. The Nodder is a nomad, I say. The basic meaning not to stay in one position, but to go this way, and then this way, and then this way. Summer, you go down to the summer, up to the summer pasture. Winter, you go down to the winter pasture, and so forth. So he went to the land of Nod, and that's where, east of Eden, and that's the way they're going to live for the rest of their days. And the mark upon Cain, there is this great tradition in Peter Matthiessen's book on the Himalayas here. He writes an interesting thing. There's a big work on this, in fact, massive work by Robert Eisler. Unfortunately, I have loaned it to somebody here on the campus and wasn't able to bring it with me today. It's just as well, because it'd use up too much time. But it's these people, these Cainites, that wander. Now, Cain is the wandering smith in Arabic, and in Hebrew, Cain is a smith, and Aramaic too, is the wandering blacksmith. Cain is a blacksmith. And he blackens his face professionally. His face is blackened because he works at the forge. This is a mark of his profession, is the blackened face, and it advertises his profession, and he wanders and so forth, and you find these. And they're great metal workers, as we'll see Cain's descendants are, and their rites are secret, they intermarry, You think of the gypsies, of course, and the gypsies belong to that particular class of people. They're always wandering. We don't see gypsies as much as we used to. There used to be a lot when I grew up in the Northwest. We had gypsies with us all the time. They would park in the back lot and so forth, and they were remarkable people. They were the Romani. They spoke a language, gypsy Egyptian, you see, but they spoke a language very close to Sanskrit, the Romani Jal and the Romani Lao. Have any of you read James Burroughs' Lavengro? James Burroughs. See, that used to be required reading from everybody. James Burroughs' Lavengro, the boy who grew up among the gypsies and so forth, and learned the gypsy language and the gypsy secrets. They have gypsy princes and so forth. For us, they're rather a sinister people. They live to themselves because they don't hesitate to steal anything like that, because that's legitimate. See, they can't make a living. The earth will not yield. They will not. They cannot plant because they say it won't grow if they do. And they tell fortunes. They have all sorts of insights. And they can really tell them, too. Oh, I've had some beautiful fortunes done, and they hit it right on the button. Well, anyway, this Peter Matthiessen writes here, "The new porters are dirt-colored men in dirty rags and small black caps carrying the curved Gorkha hatchet knife called kukri. They're not interested in the telescope. Most are the Kami people." You notice Kami, we say gypsy means Egypt, but Kami is the word for Egypt, too, and it means black. The word Kami means black, and that's why we usually say that the name for Egypt, Kami, written with a crocodile's tail, comes from the black land, whether it does or not, but it comes from the black people, too. And also, Kami and Ham, it's written also with a thunderbolt, where it's read not Kami, but Ham, and the people of Ham. See, the people of Ham, the Kami, and so forth. So these are called the black people of the blacksmith caste, soot-faced familiars of the smelting fire and of the iron stolen from the rock, feared and despised as black magicians by primitive people throughout Eurasia and Africa since the beginning of this dark age of iron. Always these people have been wandering there. You will always find them. And they're very interesting people as far as that goes. And nobody knows the source of their wealth. As they say, they take what they want. Once we were held up for half a day. It was in 1964 when they were having lots of trouble between the Arabs and Jews, and when Nasser was stirring up a great deal of trouble in Palestine. We were stopped on the border between Jordan and Syria. Yes, it was between Jordan and Syria, and there was a checking station where the army had this little checking station and would check the people that passed by. And along would come a poor old camel driver, somebody with a donkey, just looked like nothing at all bedraggled, the long whiskers, the rags, dirty and so forth. He'd come, and the soldiers had insisted that he would unroll his bundles and what he had on his camels and show what he had. And you would gasp to see what came out of those bundles. There was the most elegant silks, satins, and so forth, and jewelry, and gold plate, silver, all sorts of things. You wonder where they picked up this loot. But these were rich men, but you'd never guess if you looked at them. They looked utterly dismal. Well, this is the tribe of Cain, of Kemet, and they wander around like this. And now we get to the Cainites, and they become a regular people. It's a way of life, because there's going to be another line, too, and we're given the line here of the Cainites. He knew his wife, and because it's paralleled with another, Enoch. I thought Enoch was a holy man. Well, this was another Enoch who went and built a city. The first city builder was Enoch, and then to him was born Erod, not Jared, but I think the best thing to do is to follow the fourth chapter of Genesis here. Let's do that. Yes, we get that from the Lamech story. We'll follow. Well, might as well. Run it along. Heavy and awkward book. Yes, here we are. Why, you say kind? And if not, yes. She was pregnant and she begot so-and-so. Which one do we get here? This is the one, but is this the generation? Yes, this is it. And Cain, notice he's called Cain, he knew his wife, and she became pregnant, and she bore Enoch here. Enoch, we'll talk about his name later. And he bore next in order, so we get Cainites, first Adam. Adam is from Cain. There's a seven generations. See, we match them. And then Enoch. And he bore Erad. Now, Erad is not the same as Jared, it looks like, but it's spelled quite different. See, it's Erad. It means the person, the shy person, the person that who holds back, who withdrawn, who is unsure of himself. These people don't have complimentary names. It's a very interesting thing. And so this was Erad. I think in the Old Testament calls it Erad. Well, it does here, for that matter, in our book here. Yes, Erad, in that 43rd verse. And he begot Mahujael. Mahujael. This is another book name, Mahujael, Mahia. The Mahujael and Mahujael actually mean the same thing, and it means a person who has been smitten by God with a disease of some sort. The basic root, maha, means to have a contagious, not a contagious disease, but a chronic disease, a chronic sickness. Usually, Mahujael means smitten by God. That means you've had a divine smiting. You have been, you're paralyzed. It's a word for paralytic, Mahujael. So again, these are not very Erad. It's the shy, withdrawn person, a person who can't circulate in society. Mahujael is the person who has been smitten with palsy or with polio, something like that. It's Mahujael. Sound complimentary words. And then the next person was the Methushael. Again, that sounds Methusael. It sounds like Methuselah, but it doesn't. It isn't. You notice the reason I'm putting this on, there's going to be the Sethites, the sons of Seth, have the same, they run in seven lines, almost the same names, but they're read differently as if you were having a pun, if you were punning on them. See, like twin names. This is a typical trick. Of course, the Egyptians do it all the time. Mahujael, and Mahujael begot Methushael, which is not Methuselah, but Methusael, as it puts it here. And that means the one who has been prayed for. Well, this has a more complimentary term, doesn't it? Methusael. Methusael. Sha'el, Methusael, you see. Methusael. Supposedly that means one who's been prayed for, or one who prays, or one who supplicates. Pretty good one. And then he begets, wasting a lot of time here, he begets Lamech. And Lamech, of course, is a very sad name, because the story of Lamech, all this is building up to the story of Lamech. Lamech, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7. So here are the seven here. And Lamech means destruction, loss. Perdition. See, his name should be Perdition. So these aren't very flattering names of this particular family. And Lamech took two wives. And now we'll get to the story here that I was so interested in. First, I must give you an introduction. It's very important here. Here is a book that just came out. It's a later edition. Mahia Maria Gimbutas, The Gods and Goddesses of Europe. It deals with the old European civilization. We've been talking about the Egyptians and the Greeks and all about that sort of thing. This is much older. And this is where it all comes from, as a matter of fact. You can trace them one from the other. Here is a map showing where the old civilization is. Notice it reigns in the Balkans here. The Balkans up here, it goes down into the Aegean later on and across to Egypt. But the interesting thing is, you notice it says the gods and goddesses of Europe from 6500 to 3500 BC. That was the time when they flourished. They were much older than that. We have... There are over 30,000 artifacts from this particular civilization, and the 6500 to 3500 is when it flourished. Around 6500 it's peak. But look, that's 3,000 years older than the Egyptians. 3500, see, 3400, according to Emery, that's when the Egyptians suddenly move in and you get a new civilization, and they start full blast with the writing and everything else. Well, these people have writing. They have everything. 6500 BC, this is really knocking things over. And moreover, it can be traced back. They have some pictures of temples and shrines they had, and it's very well illustrated, and their pottery. And they have These are deliberately, these grotesque masked figures are made that way on purpose. Because there is some sculpture that shows that they were quite skillful, and they were, when they wanted to, they could make perfectly good figurines, but these things are deliberately shown as grotesque and masked, and they're dancers, and they play various roles in a drama. I want to, here, of course, is the Mother Goddess in her various forms, and how she compares with the Aegean. That's the one on the cover on the front, for example. But see, this is much older than anything we've ever heard of. You say, well, what about your primitive people and primitive civilization? Well, this fits into the picture. The conclusions here of the book, the conclusive chapter, will show us what we're talking about here, just briefly. What are these figures? Well, here, they had all sorts of ornaments fixed on them here. This is a mating scene, male and female, called the Jumalita Nitsa Lovers. Possibly the porteo connected with the ritual of the sacred marriage. And that's what we're getting here in Lamech. We're going to get this marriage business and what goes on there. Now, to get the general picture, we have to see this institution, which is so very important. We'll call it the Panegyrus here. And I'll read you, say, to get it over with, because we must consider it the Panegyrus. Now, of course, Pan means everybody, and gyrus means a gyroscope, means around in a circle. When the whole nation, when everybody meets around in the big circle, and your cosmic circle and so forth. So in ancient times, at holy shrines, each believed to mark the exact center of the universe. This is the situation, you see. Represented as the point at which the four quarters of the earth converge, the navel of the earth, always written with a quadrata like this, when it's represented. Indians, everybody has that sign, of course. And this represents the navel of the earth. One might have seen assembled at the new year, always at the new year, the beginning of time. We've had this motif before. The moment of creation, the beginning and ending of time, vast concourses of people, they'd come together. That's what you have at Stonehenge and Avebury, and well over 1,000 ancient megalithic centers scattered all over Europe. And they go to Asia. There are lots of them in Palestine, for example. Vast concourses of people, each thought to represent the entire human race in the presence of all its ancestors and gods. A visitor to any of these festivals would have found a market or fair in progress. Why? The natural outcome of bringing people together from wide areas in large numbers. And the temple of the place functions as an exchange or bank, all banks being the temple. He could have witnessed ritual contests, foot and horse and wagon races, odd kinds of wrestling, the gleema. They still have the gleema here. See, when we first came to Provo here, Spanish Fork is the oldest Icelandic settlement in America. It's older even than Winnipeg. And there were 5 wards where they still spoke Icelandic, just when I came to Provo here. And they hold their annual festival here, and they have the gleema. That's a ritual form of wrestling, the gleema. It's belt wrestling. And we find this wrestling all on the earliest glyphs, and the Egyptians, we have lots of pictures of this ritual gleema wrestling in from Egypt, from the Old Kingdom, and also from the Middle Kingdom. And it's very common, but it's sometimes it took a pretty deadly form. In the Book of Samuel, we have it mentioned that way. The idea was belt wrestling. You get hold of the other person's belt and throw him over. But the Icelandic custom is to, they didn't do it this way here, is to grab the other person's belt. And they had short knives, you see. And you couldn't let go of the belt. And you try to do as much damage as you could with the knife. It was a pretty gory affair. But this was not the point. Well, there were foot horses racing. Why? They had to pick the winner, of course. And choral competitions, the famous Troy game, beauty contests and whatnot, the Callisteia, because they had to pick the queen as well. He would note that all came to the celebration as pilgrims, often traversing immense distances. Pilgrims' roads are the oldest marks we have. We have pilgrims' roads in England going back to 4500 BC, and flying over them from the air, you can still see them because they're marked by standing stones along there, and they all converge together on Avebury, which was built about 4500 BC. And I used to have to fly over that at least twice a week, at least. And you could see where all the roads would converge from vast distances in all directions on the Kennet Mounds here where the king was buried. And this vast processional way with these huge stones, and then this enormous circle. They made it a national monument, national park since. It's a tremendous layout. Well, anyway, they often traversed immense distances over prehistoric sacred roads and dwelt during the festival in booths of green boughs. All this was done in Israel, too, you know. What would most command the visitor's attention to the great assembly would be the main event. This is what we're getting at now. The famous ritual year drama for the glorification of the king. In most versions of the year drama, the king wages combat with his dark adversary of the underworld. Emerging victorious after a temporary defeat, we already had that, you see, Moses and Faust and the rest, when you begin, your hero is overcome, he's beaten, and he emerges finally after temporary defeat with his duel, in his duel with death, to be acclaimed in a single mighty chorus. Remember, Moses is acclaimed when he is victor. The Lord says, you have won, I will make you stronger than many waters, you will lead my people, so he's to be king. Mighty chorus as worthy and recognized ruler of the new age. The new year was the birthday of the human race, and its rites dramatized the creation of the world. All who would be found in the book of life opened at the creation of the world, looks very important, must necessarily attend. If you didn't, you were banished for 3 years from the kingdom. You became an outlaw then, if you didn't come to the presence of the king when you were summoned by the royal Heror, as we read in, there's a famous saga called the Ervar Odd Saga, and you must be summoned, and if you don't come, then you will be banished from the kingdom. You have no rights whatever for 3 years. There were coronation and royal marriage rites accompanied by a ritual representation of the sowing or begetting of the human race, sometimes sexually. And the whole celebration wound up in a mighty feast in which the king, as the Lord of Abundance, gave earnest of his capacity to supply his children with all the good things of the earth. The stuff for the feast was supplied by the feasters themselves, for no one came to worship the king without bringing his tithes and furthers. Now, this is lavishly, not too lavishly, well documented in footnotes here, but I have well over a hundred such places, listed all the things they did and so forth, comparing them and matching them. And this is the pattern that emerges. That's patternism, and that's what we have here. I say, if they left this out, it would be a huge gap. And the Bible gives us just two verses on it. But the book of Moses gives us a beautiful rundown on what was going on and what the situation was. So let's see what the Bible tells us. It's just these two verses here. We'll, in the Lamech story, Genesis 19 to 24 here. And this is what happened. We might as well follow Genesis here now. And Lamech here, with his name meaning lamentation, destruction, sadness, and so forth, he took two women to wife. The one of them was called Ada. Very interesting name. Sometimes they end it with H and sometimes they don't end it with H. But who was Ada? Ada and Zillah. Now you begin to notice familiar things. Ada means, with or without an H, means the beautiful one, the adorned one. It means she's all got up. It means both masked and adorned, completely glorified. The word Zina is the same thing, Zion. It means adorned, beautiful, not only beautiful herself, but heavily made up for the whole event. Ada is the beautiful one, the gorgeous one. And Zillah has the double meaning of, in all Semitic languages, Zil means an image, a counter image, or a shade, or dark hair. It means dark, see that? Zilun, a shadow, Mazlun, shadowing, and so forth. A likeness, an image, Mathala, Thala, is a likeness, a reflection. So she's the other one. There's going to be a competition here. This is what we're going to have. We're going to have an antiphonal choruses. As I say, they have these chorals, they got to choose the king. So they have the antiphonal choruses where one chorus sings to the other, and you have that in the Book of Samuel, you have that in Chronicles and so forth, antiphonal, and they represent the competition of the maidens, and this is very important too. You get this in the corn dances of the Hopis and so forth. They divide them up the same way, but this is good old Ada and Zillah, and the name of the other one was Zillah. And, well, we might as well get through with this part of it. And Ada had, and she bore two sons, and they were Yabal. One was Yabal. We have that Jabal here, and it should be Yabal, which is quite different. See, Jabal would mean a different thing entirely, but of course in Hebrew it's a Yah here, and so it's Yabal. And which means, the same as our jubilee comes from it. It means to sing, to rejoice, to jubilate and the like. Yaval. And Hedav. And he was the father of all those who practiced tofish. Well, tofish means to strike an instrument, a kinnur. A kinnur is any stringed instrument. You notice these people, one thing about the nomads is that they practice the nomadic arts, which are portable, not architecture or sculpture or painting or even pottery. But what is it? It's weaving, it's singing, because they can take song, and musical instruments, both brass instruments. They all come out of Asia, and they're the instruments of nomads. And the same thing here. Way back from the Middle Kingdom, there is the famous Jabesh, who comes into Egypt. He's shown coming into Egypt from Palestine on a donkey with his little kids loaded on them and his wives, and they're all dragging along. And one fellow's dragging along. One is playing a harp, and they're singing. He's walking along. These nomads walking along playing a harp, because you can carry a harp with you. You notice the bards, the singers, were wandering singers. They go from court to court. They didn't settle down. So music is one of the most portable of arts. And her son Jubal, who was the lord of all, well, it's right in the line below it, says Latesh, and this is Tofesh. They're supposed to match each other, but Tofesh is to strike an instrument, or strike a drum for that, or the kinnor, that's a guitar, that's a zither. All those words are related to kinnor, a zither, and guitar related, of course. And also the ugav. The ugav is the bagpipe, the oldest of all wind instruments. Bagpipes, you find them in Crete in ancient times. Of course, you find them in Scotland, you find them in Ireland. But the Greeks had them, and you'll find bagpipes. They're extremely ancient instruments, and they were common in England earlier. But it's also, ugav means accompanying for a dance instrument, means dancing. So here we have the culture. Here we have the rock bands. The traveling rock bands are part of Cain's people. They're a very important part of it. They're mentioned quite a lot. And the kind of music they have is not contemplative, but it's wild, frenzied, and exciting. But how about Zillah? Well, she also, it said, she also bore, and she bore Tubal-Cain. Well, that's that word Cain again. And the word Tubal, Tubal, they say, is the same. It's a derived form of Yubal, Tubal-Cain. But actually, there are two interpretations. Cain means a spear, a sharp instrument, a sword or dagger. And but Cain, of course, is a smith. And Tubal-Cain, well, what's his name? Iso says nobody knows what the Tubal means, but it's related to Yubal at any rate. But Tubal-Cain was the great smith, says in Macaulay's famous rhyme on the subject. Tubal-Cain, the man of might, in days when the earth was young. The fierce sparks sprang from his anvil bright, and the strokes of his hammer rung. The mighty Tubal-Cain, who was the mighty smith here, and it says he was that. Because he was the teacher of all those who Horesh. Horesh means to smelt and to carve. The basic meaning Horesh means to carve or engrave, or it's to melt. The next is bronze, who worked in bronze, who formed bronze and iron and barzel. It comes very, very early time, you see. Ba'ahu Tubal-Cain, and that was Tubal-Cain, and his sister was called Na'ama, which means delightful, beautiful, lovely. That's a good name, finally. It was Na'ama. Now we come to a series of quatrains here, because there's a drama, and there are two choruses side opposite. The earlier versions of the Old Testament didn't put it that way, but that's the way it should be, because the lines match each other, and you have these two choruses singing together. And this chorus business is rather an important one. See what we have here. Now, the chorus of the light and the dark, I say the antiphonal here, the earliest lyric poet of the Greeks was Alcman, who left the maiden songs. It was in Sparta, in the days when Sparta was the cultural center, not Athens, way back in the 8th century, and not Athens was. And the maiden songs, they divide up into two choruses and sing to choose the queen. It's at the new year, but it has to be at dawn. and in the maiden songs, the two choruses of the colts and the doves, and they're rivals to each other. They run a foot race at dawn, you see. And the winner of the foot race is chosen, and then they sing the choruses about each other. One is Hadja Sikora, whose hair is like spun gold, and the other is a dark one, who is equally beautiful, but this rivalry goes between. There's always the light one and the dark one here. And you get that a great deal. You get it in Canticles, where King Solomon, remember? I am black, but comely. That you have in Canticles, the Song of Songs. See, it's the love song, but you have the two choruses singing for the king, and the one says, I am black but comely, and you get that one all the time, because you have then Miriam and the Ethiopian. When Moses went up on the mount, the Jews started to celebrate this in their absence, the Hebrews, and when he rebuked them for it, they set up the golden calf that they divided into choruses, and they made fun of Moses' wife Zipporah, because she was black. She was an Ethiopian. They say she was black, and that is why we're told when Moses came by back in a rage, Miriam was smitten. So you make fun of blackness, we'll make you white. And she looked and she'd become white as a leopard, became white as snow. The Lord healed her later on, but as a rebuke for having made fun of the dark one, she is made whiter than she ever wanted to be. And so we get Sarah and Hagar. Remember, Hagar was an Egyptian woman and Hagar was dark, and we're told in many traditions that Sarah was a raging, raving blonde, taffy-colored blonde, and often told that. Whereas Hagar was naturally, as an Egyptian woman, was dark, and there was that rivalry between them. And there's Abu Zaid and the rest. And Siosiris, a very famous story from the High Priests of Memphis, tells about the rivalry, about the two choruses, the black woman of the south and the... It's the Siosiris and the son of the Ethiopian, and their rivals, and their mothers put them on to each other, and they go through. I mean, this you find all over the place, and that's what we're finding here, the antiphonal chorus. And so there was this. Then we get this contest now, and this is what they sing in the contest. We're going to follow Genesis here, and what is it? Yes, and Lamech said to his two wives, Ada and Zillah. Now he recites this, and notice each line is a parallelism. He repeats this, the same thing twice each time. He says, Shimran Koli Neshei Lamech. Hear you two of them, the my voice, O wives of Lamech. And then the second half of the verse, he says, Vezanev Amarti, and give ear to what I say. Well, listen to me and give ear the same thing. And then the next line, he says, and this is the whole thing, is these next two lines is all we're told of the story, and we're told a lot more here. It's very important in the book of Moses. And Ki'ish Hagarti, very interesting word. Lefitz'i, this is the key, because I have ritually slain. See, Hagar means to sacrifice, because I have sacrificed a man for wounding me. Because it's a ritual contest, you see. It doesn't say the King James has it all cockeyed, because they have the Genesis, the objective Genesis, as the subjective Genesis, or as the objective Genesis. This is a major crux in Semitic grammar, and the Arab never stop arguing about it. The Qatl Zayd, the killing of Zayd. Does that mean Zayd did the killing or Zayd was killed? Which is it? It can be either one. There's no difference. And Gardner goes into considerable length to show that the same thing happens in Egyptian. When you say, I have killed a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt, what he actually says, he just repeats himself, I have slain a man for trying to kill me and the same man for trying to hurt me. And he won, in other words, he won the contest. It just leaves it there. We don't know what's going on until we look at the book of Moses. Ki'ish rakakti, the pitz'i wa yelet, and the young man, the chaburati. Now the words, these words that are used here for killing and slaying, the fitz'ti, if we look up in the lexicon, in the dictionary and so forth, we find what they mean. They're a special thing. This patsa, the fitz'i for wounding me, it doesn't mean wound. It means to place a cut or mark upon, to put a ritual mark. And the other, kabura, the kaburi, he says here, the kaburati, for my marking again. A kabura, I was told, is the mark or stroke of a wound on the skin. There's a conflict in which ritual wounds are inflicted. Remember, we're told that Satan showed Cain the blows of death, and this was a very important thing. He taught them to him before he could have his showdown with Abel. So does this mean that Lamech, like Cain, was marked as a murderer? See, this what's happening. Because Lamech, remember, we're going to find out very soon what this is about. Well, let's see if there's any more here. And then he says, and for Cain is avenged seven times, it says. If Cain is avenged seven times, it doesn't use if it is. For since Cain is avenged seven times, Lamech will be avenged 70 times seven. Now remember, whoever killed Cain would be avenged sevenfold. Lamech has done the same sort of thing. He goes out. But it's a 10 to 1 here. It's 70 times 7, much more than that. And again, you see, here is the ritual contest. What the women sing back and forth. Where is the, I may have it here. We get those passages, because when David came back, remember David and Solomon are competing. David and Solomon, Saul is murderously envy of David and tries to kill him because when David came back from war, the women divided into two choruses and sang. One would sing, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his tens of thousands, would be replied. See, it's 10 to 1 preference for David. The same thing is Cain versus Lamech. And the Hebrew tradition is that it was Lamech who slew Cain, that he was this was the contest. He's the successor, because we're told he was also Master Mahan, and he took charge of the society, we're told here. Well, right after this, 70 times 7, that's the end of it. And then it goes, Adam knew his wife and had another son, and it was Seth. But that's the whole story. That's all it tells us in the Old Testament. But the book of Moses tells us a good deal more here. And these others in Rome, the same thing. When the emperor came back, the only way he could be recognized, the girls were divided into antiphonal choruses. And you have antiphonal choruses. The Arval brethren do the same, the Salian brethren. And milla, 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 decola, vimos. A thousand, a thousand, a thousand we have beheaded. In order to become emperor, you have to have slain 5,000 in the field, you see. So this, the only way you could become emperor, this is way back in the early days, was to be acclaimed this way by the chorus of the maidens when they met to get the arch. You have this triumphal arch and all this sort of thing. And they would sing this milla, 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 which was the word triumph. Our word triumph, triumphe, comes from the Latin triumphus song, of which there's a good deal of them. It's our word tramp. It's very heavy. It's the, I think it's a dactylic. Trim, trim, tramp, tramp. It's exactly the way the Hopis, they dance all day long. Trim, trim, trim. And that's where triumph comes from. The triumph song was one of these. So all these things come together. But the point is, this is very old stuff, and it goes back, and you're going to run into it wherever you go. And I thought I had some references here that might be some good ones. But let's see now. But you can think of plenty of them here. As I say, the antiphonal chorus here, and Ada and Zilla. Well, of course, and the Celtic people, they're Era and Ethna, led by the white maid and the red maid. There, it's always nearly always the white and the red maid, and in Egypt, the same sort of thing. For heaven's sake, I've participated in this thing, which of course is at the May time. The maypole. And I went to school in the early days in a rural school. We had the maypole, and we went around in opposite directions, the red streamers and the white streamers, the white up, and we had to choose a king of the May and a queen of the May. The queen of the May was Vivian Johnson, I remember. I was 8 years old then, and the queen of the May, the king of May was a boy called King, which was very appropriate, because he was the biggest boy in the school, and I had this terrible crush on Vivian Johnson, which did me no good at all. Because they were the king and queen. And then we would have to bring our lunch, and we'd all go out in the fields, in the meadows, and we'd sit down among the meadowlarks, and we'd eat. It was May Day, see? This was to celebrate the new year, the beginning of the race and all this, and this is in England. This has been going on for thousands of years. We've broken all those ties. We don't have those anymore. Where we still have a commercialized Christmas and so forth. But we did that. Now you can find on the wall, especially a common wall design on an Egyptian palaces, you'll find the tall maypole and the... Remember, it's the red throne, the white throne, the red king. And you'll find the priests going in opposite directions. It's the Troy game Well, you did it with horses, and that's what a carousel is. The horses move in opposite directions. But again, it was the red and the white. In fact, I wrote my doctoral dissertation on that very thing. Nobody bothered to read it, but it's a very interesting thing as far as that goes. I'm not going to bore you with it. But no, because I handed it in 1 minute before the deadline, and nobody had any time to read it, so goodbye. No, it was published later. So anyway, here we go, this thing is going on here, and now let's look at the count in Moses. What was this all about? Lamech was the candidate, he became Cain's successor. Lamech, having entered into a covenant with Satan, after the manner of Cain, see, he's Cain's successor, remember, Cain is going to wander on the earth now, wherefore, he became master man. He is now the big cheese, and Cain is his rival. So we have the normal story, the common Jewish legend is, that Lamech, who was jealous and wanted to become successor to Cain, lay in wait for him, and that he was blind, and he took a boy, to along with him to tell him where Cain was and to direct his arrow. So he directed the arrow, and he killed Cain, and because of that, the boy was held responsible, and that's the story they made up to explain this garbled thing, in which we only have two lines in the whole Old Testament to explain what's going on. But here we got a pretty good picture. Oh, and I want to read. I didn't read you the conclusion here because that's exactly what they're doing back there, 6500 BC. And master of that great secret which was administered unto the king by the same, and Erad, his. This the sick one, you see. The son of Enoch, having known their secret, began to reveal it to the sons of Adam. Ah, somebody's giving the secret away, and of course they'd sworn by their heads that they wouldn't do that. And since Lamech was the head of the society, it was up to him to see that the proper punishment was administered, the only kind. Wherefore, Lamech, being angry, slew him. He was, because he gave away the secret, remember they swore by their heads that they wouldn't, and he did, so that's what happened. Not like unto Cain his brother Abel, for the sake of getting gain, but for his ritual obligation, for the sake of the oath. He had taken it, and Erad had taken it, so he had to do this, not to get gain. And then it says, for from the days of Cain, he started, there was this secret combination. It was done this way. And their works were in darkness, but it was a society in which they had their marks and signs, for every man knew his brother. See, this is this sinister element that you get with the gypsies and with the Cainites and so forth. You get it all the time. And the world is full of that now. For example, you find among the Hopis there are two groups. They're the two-feathered and the one-feathered that act as sort of policemen. And the two-feathered are good. They go around helping people. They only move at night, very secret, have secret societies, meet in their own kiva and so forth. But they're the one-feathered, and they are dangerous. They think they can commit murder with impunity, anything they want. They are a savage and dangerous lot. Stay away when the one-feathered people are running around, and the same thing with the Zunis. But they have these secret societies, of course, because they're secret, few people know about them. But they do exist, and they're very widespread, and they've been with us all the time. This is a Gadiant. It's a very important theme in the Book of Mormon. It pops up all over the place. But we have a lot of that going on all the way, all the time. Secret combinations for power and game. I see the time is up now. And I want to get this right. And notice what happened. Wherefore the Lord cursed Lamech and all of them that covenanted with Satan, for they kept not the commandments of God, and it displeased God, and so forth. And now here's the point. This is the pattern, and what happens? It spreads everywhere in the world. That's why you're going to find this everywhere you go in the ancient world. And their works were abominations and began to spread among all the sons of man. This is what they call, what the beginning with the Cambridge School in 1930, I said they called patternism, because it follows the same pattern wherever you go. People at Cambridge discovered it. First, people sort of laughed at it, pattern, everybody doing the same thing, but now it's very well established, no one doubts it. And it was among the sons of men and among the daughters of men that these things were not spoken, because that Lamech had spoken, and now we come to a very important thing, had spoken the secret unto his wives, and they rebelled against him and declared these things abroad, and had not compassion. And again, this is the dame fatale. Why do we have her here? I used to have a lot of, namely, the woman who gives away the secret you know about Pandora and that. But then this goes all the way down the line. Of course, this is a sort of Lilith in the line that had not. The wife gives it away, and it becomes a very important pattern. Well, I say we shouldn't linger on these things, except the fact that it is a very big chunk of world history. These old things have only been dropped, you see, in the last generation. The people were doing these things, and they still do among tribes and so forth, and more than you think. Of course, you find among the Chinese, wherever you go, you're going to find these secret societies. They are a very, very important element, as you know, have always been in Chinese society and in Hindu society and throughout the whole world. But if this wasn't part of the Book of Moses, I say we'd have a very serious defect. There'd be something lacking in this story.